You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to not an Australian act, but we're touring together in Australia. This is Carl Donnelly.
Comedy is the one thing I'm probably rarely feel down about.
Okay.
Weirdly, like I'm quite good at. I enjoy comedy to the point that I feel sort of lucky to be doing it and all that thing.
Yeah.
And it was sort of the thing that gave me some direction. So that's why I'm one of these people that is very not defensive. I'll always try. If somebody's moaning about being a comedian, if they're a professional comedian and they're moaning about it, I find that a bit annoying.
Okay.
Because there's so many worse
things.
It's
going to be a long hour, Carl. Yeah.
But there's so many worse things you could do with your life, and so many like much less fun things you can do for a living, that I think, you know, I enjoy it just constantly. I don't get annoyed with doing stand up. Sometimes, yeah, the lifestyle's a bit annoying, but you know, this trip's amazing. We're in Australia at the minute, and we are, you know, we've been brought out here because we're funny. That is an unbelievable thing to happen.
Yeah.
But saying that, sometimes you find yourself in a hotel in Leicester, you know, after two nights gigs, and suddenly it's a lonely thing. And that's, so I'm not happy with like everything, but the actual bit, the comedy bit, the sort of whatever, how long a night I am on stage, that is when I'm at my most happy.
Sure.
So like I'm happy in that. I've got, you know, I'm not the most organised. I've got other, you know, I've had things in my personal life that are not good. But comedy's always been sort of the constant, the good part.
Okay,
if that makes sense.
Yeah. So was it always like that? It's always been like you say. It's a constant. Did you discover it and think, hang on, I fucking found a thing here that's going to make me happy?
No, it wasn't always like that. I think when I first found it, I was just so excited because I'd never seen live comedy before. I was 20.
Right.
I was
okay.
Just bumming around doing jobs I hated, and I remember my mate just saying, "Oh, should we go to the Bedford in Ballard?"
Okay.
And it was a pub we used to drink in, and he was like, "Do you want to go down and do a comedy night at the weekend?" And I was like, "All right." And we walked in. It was like a Friday night. And I remember Addie Borg opened.
Okay.
And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen, probably to this day.
Yeah, we were talking about Addie Borg before, weren't we?
But it's brilliant. Because I didn't have any background knowledge. All I knew about stand-up was like Lee Evans.
Yeah.
You know, them big guys you see in an arena and you could buy a video and somebody would get it for you for Christmas or something.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that was a common thing. I thought like there was about, I probably thought there was about five comedians.
Okay. Okay.
So when I went to the Banana Cabaret at the Bedford and saw this, it felt like I was like going to some underground thing of like, oh my God, there's like 200 of us in a room. And there's this guy who's just got up and he's just playing around and having fun. And I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Okay.
And I remember just like after it, all my mates were like, no, it was good though, should we go and have a dance? And I was just like, what do you mean that was the greatest thing?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? And I was just so excited that I started going regularly. So that was how I sort of got interested in it. And it still took me about another 18 months to consider doing it.
Okay.
And then I started...
To even consider doing it?
No, do you know what it was? I started thinking about doing it. And that coincided with me meeting Marie, who is my now wife, current wife. I hope she doesn't listen to this. But anyway, she and weirdly enough, she was a comedy fan.
Yeah.
So I just got interested in this thing, and she just happened to be a fan of it. And she'd been up to Edinburgh to watch. You know, she'd been up like in the late 90s and seen like Sean Hughes and all these great comics. Okay. So she knew more about it than me, and together we started going to watch comedy. And then she was the one that said to me, "I think you should do it," just because I've always been quite sarky and silly, and I mean, you know, a lot of people are funny around a pub, but I tend to just come up with ideas and just have to say them out loud.
Sure.
So she said, "I think you should do it," and off the back of that, I started really thinking about it. And then she signed me up to this thing called the City Lit Stand Up.
Ah, you're City Lit. Okay, right. I've heard about that.
And it was terrible, terrible thing. But I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
Because whereas, like, I'm the only person that off that course now does stand up. Mm-hmm. Not the entirety of it. I mean, they're talking about my year of
sure.
the, or however, like, it's probably one every couple of months.
I'm the only comedian that has ever produced. Yeah.
But it taught me more about what I shouldn't do than what I should, I think.
How do you mean?
Well, because for like, it was all teaching you stuff that I don't think you should be taught. I think you should just work out.
Okay.
Like, I don't think you should teach somebody how to stand and how to use the mic.
Totally.
And I think, you know, and that's what a lot of these courses do, and that's why you see a bunch of flipping new comics every year coming off the Amuse Moose and City Lit. And this isn't criticism. I'm not saying courses are a bad thing.
Sure.
Because some people need that little push start.
Sure.
But just give them some advice on the open mic circuit. Like, give them bits of advice that are going to be useful. Don't tell them how to dress and stand and
wrap the mic cable around.
It's all nonsense. And a lot of the City Lit I found was that sort of stuff. And also, and I'm not criticising, the guy who was taking the course was a guy called Rob Hitchmer, who's a lovely guy. But I think I've got a very different view of comedy to him. Like, there's a couple of times where he would say, "Oh, you know, if when you're writing stuff, you shouldn't really be aiming to talk about something like this or something like that." And I was just like, at no point did he ever just say, "Look, write about whatever you want and just be funny."
Yeah, okay.
Which I, even though I had no knowledge of stand-up, from day one, that's what I thought. So I sort of was on the course almost, I felt a bit like an outsider, in that everyone else was really getting into the sort of like, right, this week I'm going to practice how to put the mic stand to the left.
Yes, sure.
And I was like, this week I'm going to try and think up some funny stuff and then say it.
Yeah, sure.
So by the end of it, and also I had to miss quite a bit of it as well because I got ill at the time. I had some stomach problems.
Okay.
So the final thing was we did a showcase at the end, and that was my first ever gig, and that was start 2004.
Okay.
So I did that, and yeah, after that gig I was like, this is it. This is what
did it go well, your first one?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
My first three gigs were really good.
Okay, three is an impressive tally to have had before.
And then I was so cocky. Like, you know, I'd done three and I'd sort of changed it each time, and I was like, I honestly, in my head, was thinking, well, I'll probably be professional in about 3 months.
Yeah.
and I remember my fourth gig just having the tank and just not, I was like, I don't know how to deal with this. You know, it was so bad that I didn't do another gig for about 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
And then, so over my first year, I did like 10 open spots, which is crap. But 2005 was when I sort of thought, I'm probably going to give this a go, and I just started gigging loads. And I really sort of, I think in them early years I wasn't as sort of chirpy as I am now about it, because, you know, you get, I think you're, it's a very competitive thing, the open mic circuit. But in hindsight, looking back, I think you should appreciate it more than you do at the time.
Yeah, that's I've not heard anyone say that before. I totally agree with you.
Because at the time, you're just like, it's so, you're like, I need to be the best on every bill. I want to win every competition. Every gig for you is a competition.
Yeah.
Whereas when you actually look back, it's the time you have the most freedom to be shit.
Completely.
You don't have the pressure of closing a gig for 300 quid or something. Where if you've got just in just like a gig where, if you're not funny, you're going to feel guilty.
Sure.
Like if you do 5 minutes on a bill with 20 acts, if you can be shit and let everyone else, like, you know, pick up the slack.
I always really, that always makes me think of Joe Wilkinson. Not because he's shit.
What? Oh, shit. Joe Wilkinson. Joe was one of the first open spots I ever saw as well. That was Bedford New Acts night. I went to watch it because when I started thinking about doing it, I went to a new act competition. Not new act competition, the Bedford New Acts, just to see what new comedy was like, and I watched Joe's first ever gig. It's fucking brilliant.
Amazing.
He was terrible.
I need to finish the thought of why I invoked him rather than just let him sound like we're slagging him off.
I thought it was just because he's a total wanker.
But the thing with Joe was, I always thought he was incredibly brave to stop. He took a pause, didn't he? He took some time out of doing it because he was going down a track that he realised, actually, I'm not doing it. I mean, I'm sort of putting words into his mouth here, but from the outside, it looked like he'd gone, I'm going down a particular route of doing something. It's not making me happy. I'm going to stop doing it and reinvent what it is I do.
What a problem.
And he almost had, once he was up and running and earning some money, he managed to retain that sense of freedom of being an open spot and being able to fail and being able to take those risks.
I think what he really didn't like was the fact that Joe, he is brilliant and his style is quite different and, you know, and I think because he was, you know, he did really well in some of the new act competitions. Suddenly people just put him to do 20 minutes.
Sure.
And yeah, he was one of the people that was, like you say, is brave enough.
Yeah.
To almost it's rare. I mean, I was one of these people that, I remember getting offered a 20 minute spot when I had about 7 minutes of material and I was like,
absolutely.
I'll just banter my way through because I was so keen to just get every gig and just do everything. But Joe had the confidence to say, no, I'm new. I'm just going to, I don't want to do a 20 minute spot when I can't do it. So it's brave.
So were you writing stuff then that was you say, just sort of talking about having funny ideas? And I think that's very, I think that's very true of what you do, is you have a funny idea and you explore it. And I think that's what keeps it so, your work is really fresh and really sort of silly and naive. I'll ask you about that in a minute. So were you writing, how has your writing changed in terms of how you come up with stuff?
I think I've got a lot more choosy about what I put on paper.
Okay.
It used to be a case of, I used to just throw every bit of shit at the wall and then just show the wall to people and hope that they could find the funny. I genuinely would just, I would write every idea down and then sort of, whatever I could try out, an open spot gig or whatever, I'd do it. But now I'm quite harsh. I think time's changed things as well, because Twitter and I do a podcast as well. Mm-hmm. So now sometimes I'll have an idea and I almost think, hang on, will it work in one of these three things? So if I think it's just a silly little idea, throwaway line, I might just think, I'll just do it on Twitter, I won't bother writing it as a bit of stand-up.
Okay, yeah.
If it's a little funny story that might not work as stand-up, I might just go, I'll tell it on the podcast. But if it's something I think could be a proper chunk of stand-up, then I won't put it in either of them two. Mm. I'll note it down in my joke book. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's not a joke book.
I've seen it, it's a Carl's joke book on the front.
So I almost now I've got a lot more ways of filing it. In the past, I just had all this crap in my head, and I would just throw it all into a notebook, and then not really understand how to work it out.
So, what would you try and do in the early days of gigging?
I'd just say it. I was just I'd either say it or I'd ignore it all. And I actually think I didn't turn over enough material for my first couple of years. Mm-hmm. Once I got my first 10, 15, 20 sort of thing, I really I think it happens to a lot of people when you go full time. 2007 when I went full time, I quit the day job and suddenly I was making just enough to live. I think you get so excited to not have a day job that you get really unproductive because you think I can sit around all day every day.
Yes, this is my this is my my reward for having gone full time.
And it's that thing where when you want to do it so hard and become a professional, you write so much more and you just chuck everything down as you're trying to do it. But the moment you get given it, you're like, all right, now I'm going to sit back for 18 months and put my feet up. So I think, I went a bit unproductive for them sort of early. That bit went out, between 2007 and 2009. It was probably after my 2009 Edinburgh show that I started properly getting back on it.
Yeah.
Because that was a best of Edinburgh, that show was my debut.
Yes, that's your debut year.
So that was all the material I'd built up till then. Mm-hmm. And after that, I was all right, I've used that now. I need to start properly being productive again. So that was when I started actually putting more new ideas out there and going and doing more new material nights and things like that.
So you're not someone, I mean, in the time that you, me and Jimmy have spent kind of working on ideas together and having that sort of workshop environment, you don't strike me as someone who writes kind of jokes, do you know what I mean? It's no. Like you're very, very loose in what you do, and you have an idea and you go on and sort of play around with it.
Yeah, yeah. I've never written a bit out like longhand before I've said it on stage. A lot of times, actually, I went through a phase of trying to do this thing of not writing it down before I've said it on stage. So if I had an idea, I don't know, I just thought I'd try it. And I probably did it for about a year. So I'd have an idea, and I mean, I'd make a note in my phone of like the word. So if something funny happened on a ski slope, then I'd note ski slope in my phone.
Okay.
But then I wouldn't think about it. Then what I do is go to like Old Rope or something in London,
okay,
and just tell the story how I remember it.
Okay.
And if I made it funny while just telling it as if I was telling somebody,
okay,
like a friend, and they were laughing, I would then think that's funny enough to sit down and think it out.
Sure.
So that was sort of a while, but now I've got a bit more, not serious about it, but now I actually will, if I have an idea, I'll sit and do some pre-thought on it and then make a few notes and then go to like Old Rope or somewhere like that and just riff on it for 5 minutes and work backwards from there.
Okay.
Which I think is quite, you know, it's good, and all, but not all the time, because now, like me, you know, me, you and Jimmy have sat around and thrown ideas around. About a year ago, me and Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay, the comedian Chris Martin, we started, like, because we've always helped each other out of ideas.
Okay.
Like, it's for 3 or 4 years, like, if one of us is struggling with an idea, we'd always meet up or ring the other one. But what we started doing about a year ago was having, like, weekly, like, coffee or lunch, whatever, where we'll meet and spend 2 hours just throwing ideas back and forth. Like, I'll say, look, this week I've got these ideas, what do you think? And I'll say it, and just by talking it through over lunch, we come up with so much. I actually end up, when I take it to the stage for a, even if I'm taking it to the stage in a, on a new material night where you're allowed to piss around a bit, I've already got maybe 3 or 4 lines that I'm pretty confident are going to be funny, which I've never had before. That's something I've sort of really worked on this year, is actually having it a bit more ready when I try out a new material night.
Okay. So you're going in there with what? With sort of points going, well, I'm going to describe it for a bit and then get to that punchline, which I'm fairly sure is funny.
Yeah.
And then play with it and get... So you're kind of hooking it onto...
Yeah. Or as long as I know... Right, I know why I'm saying it. I know that I think it's funny. And I know why it will be funny at the end. Mm-hmm. And if I've got just a few pointers in between that I think will be like... laughs along the way, then I'm happy just to see what happens on the journey. that was jokingly pretentious, by the way.
No, I'm leaving it in. I'm going to cut you explaining. I'm going to cut you explaining that it was jokingly pretentious.
So, welcome to the show. The reason I'm keeping my voice down is that Carl and I are actually living together in Adelaide. I've just interviewed him in our living room, and last week he... and he's hiding outside the door listening to me recording this show, so I'm trying not to creep him out by being too audible. You may have heard him shouting in the background there. Many of you will know and love Carl's stuff. We started around the same time and we were in a lot of the same new act competitions together, but I hadn't really spent any time with him properly till now, nor seen his act in a long while. He's been absolutely smashing it in Adelaide and I'm a really big fan of his work. We're going to talk about all the usual stuff, truth in comedy, his persona on stage, but we can't really go into how he copes because he's just too bloody happy. The best I could do is, in the later stages of the interview, get him onto the subject of comedians and comedy tropes that annoy him to try and get under the skin of this aggravatingly well-adjusted man. So I've got some great Australian acts coming up for you over the next few weeks, and as I said before, once we get to Melbourne in a week or two, I'll be able to see a lot more shows and consequently get stuck into a lot more interviews for you. info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to send me any suggestions for guests or feedback on the show. I promise I'll read everything, but it might take me up to a month to reply. Tweet me at comcompod and join the Facebook group for these special treats you can get there once I decide what they're going to be. Probably priority booking for the next Comedians Comedian Live, which is going to be in May, I think. Details on that in the next few weeks. So I'll announce that first to the Facebook group. There's going to be, again, strictly limited numbers. So, join the Facebook group. There we go. That'll do us for now. Back to Carl Donnelly.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
It seems to me, from the way you work, that you feel safe on stage. You feel happy and comfortable on stage. There's no, I can't put this, there's no terror in your eyes at any point. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like the volume of material that I've seen you turn over in the last month, in the last 3 weeks, where you'll have an idea, talk about it, go up on stage, very boldly chuck yourself into it, and know where it's going or sort of talk through it. I mean, like that story about the ostrich has gone boom, 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 but that's huge. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's how, yeah, because that was a very new story when we got here, and it was probably a minute and a half long, and now it's, you know, it can be like 3 or 4 minutes if it goes.
Yeah. And people listening to this in the future will recognise this as the origins of Carl Donnelly's seminal ostrich.
My hour-long ostrich DVD.
I was just wondering, though, is that, do you think that's because you feel happy to fail? Do you feel like there's risk on stage? Do you feel like you seeing part of this, part of your comfort, part of your happiness with the thing, is that you're prepared to take the risk of it not working?
Oh yeah, I definitely don't mind failing. And it's not in a sort of horrible way, but I think it comes with, you know, and you've done it as well, a lot of comparing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I am confident enough on stage that, you know, I'd never go out and just throw myself into 10 minutes of new stuff at a proper gig.
Sure.
Like, I know for a fact if I've come out...
Can't consider some gigs not to be proper gigs.
Some of them aren't. Come on. Not going to name names. But, I think normally you spend a couple of minutes showing them that, look, I am funny, chill out. And once you've got their faith and they know that you're confident and... if you go out looking scared, then obviously... it's not really going to go to plan, is it? But, you know, I go out, I spend a couple of minutes, like, letting them know who I am, letting them know that they're in, you know, safe hands.
Mm.
And then, after that point, I think I am good enough at winning them back that if I do try something new that doesn't get what, you know, maybe I thought it would, then I'll just get them back in the next bit.
Mm.
I've got no fear of them not liking a bit.
Sure.
Like, yeah, I don't really understand it. And if what's the worst thing that can happen in the world at that point is they don't laugh.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world. Like, even if you have a shocking gig, like, you know, if I have a shocking... the only gigs I get really upset if I have a bad gig at are ones when I threw it away.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I don't get upset if, you know, 10-20% of the audience don't like me.
Mm.
It's just, well, it's still a pretty good average, isn't it? Like, you're not going to please everyone. So, yeah, I've got not, you know, I don't really get scared about
something. And has it always been like that? Have you always been
No,
like
I think the first few years, it's probably only up until about the last 18 months, 2 years, where I've finally, I suppose, I don't know if you want to, there's that whole thing about finding your voice, but I don't know if I really believe you find your voice. I think you sort of, find what's funny about you and then just keep rolling with that.
Well, this was my next question, because I think of all the comics I know, you are someone who is the same on stage as they are off stage, but in a quite an unusual way.
Right.
Because I think a lot of people, or some comics, you know, we all know people who have built their comic persona for the stage, and then they wander around in it the rest of their lives. It's almost like they've got this clothes that they put on to be on the stage, but they wear their costume off stage the whole time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So they're busy being the comedian. Whereas you, I think, come at that from the other direction, in that there's you, and you're comfortable in who you are, and you're happy, and you're funny, and then you walk on stage and just be you.
Yeah, but I'd be a much more cocky version of me.
I don't know if it's that much more cocky. I'm not calling
having
you cocky.
Having hung around with you.
Having hung around with you all week, I find there's...
really?
There's very little difference between you on stage and off stage.
Oh, cool. I'm glad about that. Because I've always thought that on stage was the much... I feel better on stage than I do off stage.
Do you?
Well, yeah, I feel more confident on stage. The moment I get that mic in my hand and I'm on stage, I feel like, oh, right now, this is the proper me.
That's
and then I come on stage, and yeah, I'm comfortable being me. I'm totally happy, like who I am. But yeah, on stage, that's why I think I enjoy doing it so much. Because when I'm on stage, I feel like sort of it completes me. No, no.
I'm cutting the no. And I'm leaving that. I'm playing Sting. It completes me.
It completes me. No, I just feel like that. Yeah, suddenly it all clicks into place, and that is how. You know, I'm not as confident in real life. I'm a laugh off stage, and sure. I'm in a dressing room. I'll always be messing around, and I think that's good. But if you put me in a room full of total strangers mm-hmm. on my own, where mm-hmm. I'm not with like comic mates and that,
sure.
I'm much more restrained. Sure. I'm a bit more chilled out. I'm still like, I'll chat to everyone. If somebody asks me something, I'll probably be capable of being witty or funny. But when I'm on stage, I think I genuinely am like the most confident person in that room.
Mm-hmm.
I totally, I'm not, anyone could say anything that won't affect me. Like, yeah. That's why I don't really get annoyed with hecklers and things like that, because okay. it doesn't really bother me. It's like, I know that I'm going to be funnier than them.
I think people listening to this who aren't comedians will find that particularly fascinating, that you feel more confident on stage in front of an audience, the thing which terrifies a lot of people,
suppose, yeah.
than being in your normal life.
Yeah, but it's all because of like the mic and the lights and all that. I know it sounds weird, but like I did a gig recently, it was a new material gig, and I got there and they were like, there's no mic. And I genuinely was like, oh my God.
Okay.
Because it does, I need that. I need the status thing. I need okay. the mic. I need the lights on me. I need the high stage.
Okay.
I need to be dressed for the stage.
Sure.
Like, you know.
We'll get onto the dress, didn't you?
But that's what I need to. I don't know. The moment I've got all that on me, like, and I walk on stage, it's like all the stuff I've got off stage, which, you know, I've got everything I need for that. But that's when it suddenly clicks in. It goes into that gear that I don't have the rest of the time. Yeah. And I'm like, you lot can fucking sit back and shut up.
Yeah,
this
okay.
is my time.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, maybe it is that sort of. I don't know. Some people always, like, Marie always says to me, like, I'm probably just seeking that sort of little thing, whatever, that I get on stage. But I've always sort of disagreed with that, but I think she's probably got a point.
Sorry, how do you mean?
What, like, Marie, she says that, you know, she's got her theory that, you know, as a non-comic, she says that all comedians have something missing from their life that they get from doing comedy.
Sure.
Even the ones that are really sort of nervy on stage and will do just their one-liners and get off, whatever.
Yeah.
Everyone, nobody goes on stage who isn't searching for something.
Yes, okay.
You know. And it's always selfish, I think. No one's going on because I just want to make people laugh. Shut up. No, you're not a priest. Right? Yeah. You're not doing it to just help the people.
Sure.
Priest is probably, in the current climate, the wrong thing. But what I mean is, everyone does stand up for a selfish reason.
Yeah.
But I think most good comics are doing it because that's where they sort of can, you know, share their opinions, or they can, you know, get something of themselves out there, and, you know, just talk to people, whatever. Some people obviously have more selfish reasons of just wanting to be on telly or something like that.
Sure.
But yeah, so I think I probably do it because that's when I feel at the best. I feel like I'm the most sort of, I'm in the most comfortable state I can be in on stage.
Okay. And you, how should I put this? You're not kind of running away from anything in your personal life. You seem to have a very happy, well-adjusted personal life.
I mean, I'm not. I don't think I'm running away from anything. Like, all of that, I don't. No, because if I was, I think I would have ditched all my personal life stuff to do comedy. Like, yes. If anything, I'm the opposite. Most of my close friends are non-comedians.
Okay.
Like, when I started comedy, I made sure, I met so many comics who just didn't have any friends, you know what I mean? I know some comics now who only have a handful of comic friends, you know what I mean? Because they ditched all their real life for comedy. But I was never running away from life. I was running away from getting up in the morning and, because I didn't.
That is a tragic question.
What I mean is, I was running away from I was running away from being unhappy with my daily situation. I'd hated every job I ever did.
Okay.
And I just didn't know what I wanted to be, but it just so happens that when I saw stand-up, that was what I wanted to be, but I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
So I'm not running away. Yeah, I've never been running away from anything. I'm pretty happy across the board.
I'm not quite sure whether you're agreeing with Marie or disagreeing with
her. Well, no, I think now I'm agreeing. I used to disagree, but now I do think, like, no matter what your reasons for doing stand-up, it normally is to fulfil something that is missing in your psyche or subconscious or something.
Okay.
And for me, I think, because I was never that confident when I was young. Like, I was a real sort of little chubby idiot.
Really?
And then, yeah, I was rubbish. And I remember getting bullied when I was about 11. and I was in a really crap, rough school in Streatham, and I was just hanging out with like horrible bastards, and like, you know, I was just getting into trouble and that. And I remember like my mum moving me into another school, which wasn't great, but it was better. And there, I sort of was suddenly was like, right, I'm gonna hang out with some bigger boys and just be the funny fat one, and okay. I did that. So, but even then, but I was never that confident. I was always just a little bit sarky. So I think that I've always wanted to be confident, and I think I got more and more confident sort of into my like late teens and 20s. And then when I did stand up, the first time I walked on stage and was like, suddenly I became super confident. I think it was like a, you know, it's like a drug, isn't it? It's suddenly like, shit, I'm the most confident man in the room right now. So I suppose that is what it was. That's what I subconsciously get from it, if I was a psychologist, but I'm not. Just like their jokes, isn't it?
Yeah, I wonder if there's anything more to add on your persona on stage, because it's not something that seems remotely worked on. You don't seem like you ever made any decisions about how you're going to be on stage, or
I've never.
Sure.
If anything, any decisions I've made about how I am on stage has been to stop myself from doing anything that is sort of planned.
Okay, so you've made decisions about what not to do on stage.
Yeah, like the thing, like, I mean, you've probably seen like some. I don't stand normally on stage. I don't sort of walk around.
Oh, you
normally.
Say you put yourself into shapes to make yourself laugh.
I don't. You know, some people sort of have a very set when they go on. They're like, they might leave the mic in the stand and stand behind it and hold the mic stand. Some people take it out and hold the mic and sort of be quite still. Some people pace back and forth. Mm-hmm. I don't think about what I'm going to do. I don't think about how I'm doing it while I'm on stage. So sometimes I will find myself like mid bit, and I'll look down and I'm sort of crouching down.
Yeah.
And I genuinely just catch myself doing it because I don't like to sort of think about how it looks. I'm too busy saying it. And I also think it's funny sometimes for an audience to see me telling a bit, and I will have, you know, one leg up on a speaker or something just for no reason. And then some of them are probably thinking, he's got his leg on a speaker. So when I stop and sort of realise and go, oh shit, so I've got my leg on the speaker.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's sort of a funny moment when they realise that I'm not this, you know, super, you know, planned comedian who's gone on. Everything I'm doing on stage is pre-planned and thought out and it's conscious. A lot of the stuff I'm doing with my how I look on stage is totally unconscious.
Well, let's talk about how you look, because you're not wearing them at the moment. You're wearing a simple pair of sandals, which is most of your feet we've seen all week.
Yeah, I know.
But you recently purchased some plum colour suede. Are they ostrich? Are they ostrich?
They're just a suede Chelsea boots
with a large heel.
They've got a Cuban heel.
They've got a Cuban heel.
I like a Cuban heel. I gave up wearing trainers 3 years ago.
Okay.
On stage. And that was just...
That sounds like you made a decision.
No, it wasn't off on stage, it was off stage.
Okay.
I decided to stop wearing trainers in day-to-day life. It was about 2 years ago, because it was just when I was getting near 30.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I just had a moment where I was like, what am I wearing trainers for? I'm a grown man. And I started wearing shoes and liked them, and I started wearing some boots. And then obviously I would wear what footwear I had on stage.
Sure.
And then sort of I got my hair cut from the long hair to the short hair.
Yeah.
And again, that was because I think I kept the long hair. That was one of the few things I kept, I think, for comedy, like my long hair, because it was big and it was silly, and I'd get a laugh before I got to the mic.
Yeah.
And sort
God,
of
I just suddenly had a flash of seeing you years ago with a massive hair.
Oh, it was so big, like it was proper Sideshow Bob hair. And then it would basically get a laugh, and I'd walk to the mic and people would probably think I was some like really geeky sort of guy, and then I'd be this sort of weird sort of cocky little South London idiot. So it was a weird, it made me sort of come across quite weird, I think, and people didn't know what to make of me. But I think I kept the hair for too long, because it was doing my head in for about 18 months.
Sure.
And then finally I was like, I'm just going to cut my hair to look like an actual man.
Yeah. But the way you dress on stage with your kind of rhinestones on your denim jacket and stuff like that. And also, I'm thinking, bearing in mind that a line you've been opening with a lot on this tour has been, this is how I look all the time. You know, I'm hard on me, this is how I look all the time. You're sort of, it's like, I don't know how conscious this is, but it sort of feels like you're being very gently provocative. You're almost being like, look how silly I am. I mean, I think you even said something maybe a week or so ago, but you, like, you're sort of, I can't remember how you put it, but it was something along the lines of, you want them to see that you're not an idiot, but yeah, someone that doesn't quite fit into the world.
Yeah, because
in
I'm
the
not,
same way as everyone else.
But I think, because I'm not like somebody, I don't think I fit in properly in terms of like how I dress. I've all, out of all my mates, like, my mates have come from all different backgrounds and jobs, and you know, I've always dressed weird. Like, yeah, from, I remember, like, when we'd be 18, 17, going to nightclubs or whatever, they'd all be dressed in like their sort of Ben Sherman shirt, jeans, loafers, and I'd go out in some wacky flowery shirt, and I've always sort of dressed. I think it was that thing, because like I said, I didn't used to be very confident. When I got some confidence, okay, suddenly was like, right, I'm dressing this
I'm
up.
I'm going to get, okay, and okay, okay. I'm making just, the most of it.
Yeah, and I think that falls into now, how I dress, and, you know, I like wearing sort of Cubanil boots and bloody sort of, you know, weird jackets. I went through a phase of wearing leather jackets on stage, but then I thought, I just look like a wanker.
Yeah, the fine line, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like the brown leather jacket. I reckon that's the hardest item of clothing to pull off as a comic.
the brown leather jacket.
It's a hair's breadth away from, like, between sort of looking like, you know, somebody does look quite a cool guy, and look at that twat.
And you can tweet at ComComPod if you've seen anyone pull off a brown leather jacket on stage.
Seeing an open spot in a brown leather jacket is like, it's like seeing a dodo. you'll see one and you'll be like, oh, this is a great, you'll text a mate, and after seeing an open spot in a brown leather jacket. But yeah, I used to wear leather, because I wear leather jackets the rest of the time, so I just wear them on stage. But
so it's sort of a celebration of your confidence.
Yeah, it's sort of like, look, and that's why I say this is how I dress all the time, because if you walk on and you've got big boots, and you've got like tight jeans, and you've got freaking wacky hair, and you know, hipster glasses, chances are, you know, there is going to be a bunch of people in there thinking, this guy's going to be a prick.
Yeah.
And there's also going to be some people thinking that I have dressed up like that just for the stage.
I've never seen it like that.
I look all the time, it's sort of saying to them, look, just this is, I'm not just doing this, I'm not I used to have a line where, when I had the big hair, and I'd say, I'm not a character actor. I used to say, this is my actual head. And it's just that thing of saying to them, look, I'm not just a prick, this is just how I look, so let's get over that and get into the
That's a real power move. That's a real confident move as well, to come on and go, I look weird, I know I look weird, I'm really comfortable with it. Makes everyone go, oh, we're all comfortable with it as well.
Yeah. So it's not as contrived, I think, as some people would think.
I want to talk about how influential you've been on the circuit. I think this came up.
Well, you said this, and I didn't.
Okay, well, let me clarify terms, and just for the sake of the listener, I think a lot of people, a lot of acts who started after you, in the years after you started, slightly copy your voice.
I'm not going to say names, but I've had there's a few newer acts who I have had quite a lot of texts from other comics saying, just seen so and so.
Yeah.
It's like a little version of you.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know, but it's just, I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not.
Sure.
Because sometimes you see people that just talk similar or sound similar, innit? But, yeah. I've seen a couple of new acts who have sort of, you know, even said to me, like, oh, I'm a big fan of yours.
Yeah.
And then I've watched them, and they do sort of have a bit of...
And you've gone, you are a big fan.
But no, they've sort of had a bit of the stance and a bit of the, you know...
Yeah.
A bit, like, sort of certain wordings and things like that that I use. And yeah,
wordings, for example, which isn't a word. If we hear anyone use the word wordings, that's like a genetic
thumbprint. Yeah. But, you know, sort of the way they'll sort of say things I think I can sort of see this. I've seen it a couple of times, but I don't think it's, you know, influential makes it sound like way bigger than it is. Two people.
But I also think, not just in the way you say things, but I think you I think you tell a lot of stories about things that have happened to you and things that have happened to your mates.
Yeah.
And you do that in such a way that those stories contain hundreds and hundreds of jokes and angles and silly ideas.
Yeah.
And I think it's easy to see that. And I think people, I'm sure people have done this. And I think you're kind of one of, almost like one of the front runners of that thing where rather than come up with rather than have an act card, you just talk about shit that happened
during your turn.
I think in the same way as, for example, when Whimsy kind of exploded, Josie Long was doing something where she'd drawn a picture and had six brilliant jokes about it. And it's easy for people to watch that and go, oh, what you do is you draw a picture.
Draw a picture on your belly. That's not the joke. The joke is what she does with it.
And I think in the same way, it's easy to see you telling stories about some funny thing that happened to your mate and go, oh, you need to tell a funny story about something that happened to your mate. Yeah, I think you've been quite influential in that way as well. I think you've been quite copied, if you like, rather than influential.
Well,
I think there's a lot of people now telling, to be fair, quite bland stories about things that happened to them and going, my God, it was... Basically, this is what the comedy courses now say. Imagine that you know one of Carl Donnelly's friends. What sort of scrapes might you get into?
But the thing is, that's because, it's just a good... I've got a lucky mix of very funny friends and I've got the ability of making it funny. I make it funny to other people.
Sure.
Because it's not funny sometimes. Yeah, I've seen comics say, something funny happened to my mate, and then they tell it, and you're like... All right, cheers for that.
Even if it's funny, you think, well, what are you telling me? What's your opinion?
There's a definite way of doing it. You've got to tell it this is what I said, I think I said it earlier, about everything you say on stage, you've got to know why you're telling it.
Mm.
Like, you can't... you've got to basically... All my stories have it at some point in it a little opinion about why I'm saying it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if it's because I just want to, say... What's a good example?
Oh, well, like the bit about how much would you be paid to fellate a man.
Yeah,
the point is, what price would you put on your sexuality?
I sort of say that, I'm going to tell you this story about something my friend said in this conversation, but basically the point is, it's a good thing to think about, whether or not you could.
Yeah.
So I sort of almost say that, listen to the story, but think about it for yourselves. Because I think sometimes just saying, this happened, it's like, oh right.
Yeah.
There's no real, don't get much of you in it.
Sure.
Because a lot of the stories I tell, which I only thought about this recently, I think it was Stephen Grant said this to me after I did a Comedia gig with him, and he's pointed out that most of my stories are stuff that wouldn't happen to other people. That haven't happened to other people. So I'm not telling the story like...
It's not like you know when.
Yeah, you know when this happens to you. It's not like most of them are not... I'm not like doing it from the point of view of one of them. I'm doing it from this is something that's funny that's happened to me.
Yes.
You need to know this just in case. Because I think it is easier to tell a story when it's something that happens to everyone.
Yeah.
But sometimes people probably see what I do and think I'm just telling some funny stories and being their mate, and they're that happens to us. But when you actually look at it, most of my stories are things that have not happened to people. Like most of them, I don't know anyone else that's accidentally showed a hairdresser a picture of him having a shit. I don't know anyone else who's sort of been had a weird moment with an emu. Most of my stories, I don't know many people that have got into a stranger's car or seen a guy fart on a train and congratulate himself, and all these stories that happen on stage, I'm telling them in a way that makes people get into it and imagine themselves in it, because that's how if you're a good storyteller, that's what you do. You put them in the story, you make them feel like they're in the story because you explain the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes people probably see it and think it's just easy, he's just telling a funny story that happened, but it's not. Oh, it's actually quite difficult, guys.
So let's talk about truth then. How much of in one of your routines?
One of your sketches. That's what old people always say. Yeah, stand-ups.
In one of your sketches then, in one of your stories, how much of it is word for word what actually happened? How much is artistic license, and how much, if any, is pure invention?
I try and keep it as true as possible. That emu story currently being done is pretty much, I'd say 90%.
So the emu did look round. Marie is scared of birds. She has a bird phobia.
And the emu wasn't it was probably, in the story I sort of suggest he was right by my face, he was probably about a foot away, which is still very, very close to your face.
Sure,
to turn and see an emu staring into your
eyes. I can't believe that emu was like 7 inches more than you'll make it out on stage.
And that happened. We walked in and we saw kangaroos and it distracted us, and then sort of, you know, I did say to her, I'll keep an eye out for any emus. So this story, like, it sounds ridiculous, it sounds made up, but that's how it happened. And she ran out and we got out of there, and, you know, and yeah, all the other sort of, most of my stories are pretty much true. I try and keep them as true as possible because I'm not actually a particularly good liar. I won't find it. I need to find it funny or I won't say it on stage.
Okay.
And if I am making it up, chances are I'm not finding it funny. It's like a good example being, unless I tell them it's made up.
Yes.
Like, I've got this oyster story.
Oh, of course,
thing,
the oyster story, yeah.
Where?
Is that on YouTube or somewhere? I want to be able to direct people to see
it. No, it's something that I don't know what to do with it. It's basically, I don't, it's a weird one. I think it's the most original bit of stand-up I've done.
Okay.
Because I haven't seen anyone else ever do a joke in that format.
Yes.
Where you tell them, it's a story within a story.
Yes.
But, and I also tell them the punchline at the start.
Yeah.
I tell them how it's going to end. I tell them that it's all made up.
Yeah. But I mean, you tell them it's going to, it's almost like you're saying, I'm going to tell you a Shaggy Dog story now.
Yeah, so the crux of it is, I tell them a story about telling somebody a story over dinner as to why I didn't eat oysters, or why I don't eat oysters. But I've told the audience that I made it up. So they are listening to it from my perspective.
Yeah.
But they're also in on the joke that the person hearing the story didn't know it was made up.
Yes, and they're also really enjoying the story and not knowing what's going to happen next.
And then what I do is do the story for 5 or 6 minutes, and it's not a funny story. It's just totally like played out for real about a story of ended up on an oyster fishing boat and my mate getting washed overboard. And I do it for long enough and serious enough that they get really into it.
Yeah.
And then the punchline, even though they know it, is still a surprise.
Yes.
So it's sort of, when I came up with it, like, there was no way of knowing if it was going to work. The first time I did it, I just had to plow into it for 5 minutes and hope that at the end it worked. And it did. And I remember just the relief. It was the only time I've ever been midway through a bit of material and actually had my heart racing and thinking this might not work.
Okay.
And when it did, I was just, like, totally relieved and just really, like, it felt like the most original thing I've ever come up with. What were we talking? How did we get onto this? The question was about...
We're talking about truth, how much stuff's true.
Oh, yeah, but the reason I could just do that story and just say it and convince them it's true and have the punchline and they'd be like, oh, but I don't like it because it's made up. So I'd like to I tell them it's made up because otherwise I don't think I could fully commit to it.
Okay.
I need to be truthful or I think it comes across. And it annoys me because I remember the only time I've ever had an issue with something somebody said about me online was a couple of years ago, and I don't read any of that shit. I don't Google myself. I don't look at my name on Twitter or any of that stuff. I'm very sort of just.
Yeah, you know, you're never tempted to.
About 2 years ago, okay. I totally stopped.
Brilliant.
And I wanted to. I phased it out because I was just getting a bit bored of it. But a couple of years ago, somebody sent me a link to something somebody had put on my Chortle review page. Mm-hmm. I had my Chortle review, and then it had, you know, there's a comment section underneath it. And a guy had basically just gone off, bloody cold. So he really sort of slapped me off and said that I make up all my stories and that sort of, I can't remember what it was. It was just really horrible.
Oh, that was me. I posted it.
But like, if the guy had just said, I think Carl Donnelly is shit, I wouldn't have any issue.
Okay.
But the fact that what he said was totally wrong.
Yes.
It was the only time I've ever read anything about me that's upset me.
Okay.
And I contacted Steve Bennett and said, look, this guy's put a comment, I don't know who it is, but he said that I make up all my stuff, which is actually incorrect, so I think, can you take it down? That's the only time I've ever done anything like that.
Okay.
Because I really take it seriously that I'm not a liar on stage. It's, you know, so yeah, you can embellish the truth, but I'm not, if I tell an audience this is how it happened, that's how it happened.
Why do you think that's so important to you?
Well, it's nice, because I tell them it's true. Like, I think, I don't know why it's important to me, I just don't think I could just. Well, I suppose maybe I could make up some stuff, but I don't think I'd be able to deliver it as well.
Okay.
I need to, because when I tell a story, I never write a full story out.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I do a story, I know the punchline or how the big ending. I know sort of why I get into it. I tell them why I'm telling them it, and along the way, I know some like funny bits I've come up with, like funny little punchlines. But I never like I always leave room to elaborate, and I always leave room to catch myself off guard when saying it a different way, or maybe like chucking in something that I'd forgotten, and that's because I'm telling it from memory. Yeah. So it's really fun to be retelling a story as if it's the first. You're telling it to these people.
Yes.
And the way you're telling it is the only time you'll ever tell it in that way.
Yeah.
And if it's true, it's much easier. If you're making it up, it's harder, isn't it, to make it
funny. But why, specifically in that example, what was it that you felt he was attacking? Like your integrity?
He was claiming that what I'd done, or I don't know where he'd seen me or what he'd seen me on, but he was, he wasn't saying, in my opinion, Carl Donnelly makes up his stuff.
Sure.
He said...
Oh, as if he was revealing the...
He was saying as if he had some secret that I... And this
sort
of cynical liar who goes around going, guys, this happened to me recently, and I'm secretly sitting at home going, it didn't.
Yeah.
Writing out this story. I didn't even know somebody called Paul.
Yeah.
But it's when it was so... that was the only thing that upset me, that he genuinely said, like, Carl telling his real stories and just, like, sort of just suggested I was some, you know... lying bastards.
So when you go up to Edinburgh, which you do frequently, you don't engage with the press at all. You don't read reviews of other people's shows or anything like that.
I am. What was it? 2011 was the first year I didn't look at any of my reviews, and I still like, you know, that thing of accidentally, you know, sitting down on a paper and you pick it up and there's a review and you read. I sort of caught a few, not of mine but of other people, but. Last year, I just totally was like, I'm not even going to do that. If I see a paper, I'm just going to ignore it. I don't really read anything about any comedy criticism anymore. I just can't be bothered. It's just, I don't think it's for us, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, a reviewer is essentially a professional audience member, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they're at the show to review it, to give their feedback to the potential audience members, to say, this is what I thought, see what you think.
Sure.
You're never going to be that person. You're never going to be an audience member to your own show.
Yeah.
So why are you reading what it's like for them? And also, what are you going to get out of reading a review? If you read a good review, what are you going to do then? Just keep your show exactly as it was that night?
Yeah,
or if you read a bad review, what are you going to do? Change it, in which case you didn't have the faith in it in the first place.
Yeah.
So you need to get your own conviction sorted and not worry about it, I think. Which I understand. I make it sound easier than I realised it was. Because when I say to loads of comics, like good mates of mine, comics, and I say like how I don't read them, and I think for the first year or two, I don't think they believed me. I think they were like, yeah, but you're saying that, but you do.
Yeah, okay.
And I was like, I genuinely don't. And they were like, yeah, but it's so hard. It's like, it's really not hard to not type chortle into your web browser. It's really not that hard to go out and buy the Scotsman. You know, you don't even have to avoid it. You just don't. Just don't actively look for it, and you won't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really easy. But I understand. Like I'm saying that, but I think you should find the time when you stop doing that. I think early years, it's hard. It's really hard. You know, I mean, you remember getting your first ever review and things like that. I think that's sort of a rite of passage. But I think once you've found your comfort levels and you're confident in what you're doing, and you're happy in the place you're doing it from, and everything like that, then you're done. Just give up looking at it all, because it's no longer got any point to you. And then you can take up meditation like I did and find Zen.
Tell me about meditation.
Oh, really? All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I started meditation.
You're a happy, successful comic, and if you now tell me, oh, it's because of meditation, then we're all going to go and do that.
No, it's not. Meditation came afterwards.
Okay.
Meditation is what, because meditation is sort of what I started using because of having, like, you know, I've got a bit of an overactive brain, which is part of why I've always come up with silly ideas and why I sort of probably got into comedy and found it so good. But them ideas don't stop when I'm off stage. You know what I mean? It's on stage when I'm at my most probably calm. You know what I mean? It's that weird thing. Like, now having done meditation, people think you reach calm there. My brain is at the most peaceful when I'm on stage. It's such a weird thing. I don't know if you have it. Whereas, if I'm sitting in a dark, like, quiet room, my brain is like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
When I'm on stage, I don't hear my thoughts, it just happens.
Someone told me there's a concept of that, it's called flow.
More
flow. It's like when anyone is doing a thing that they do well and they lose themselves in it, that kind of, that's known as flow by someone.
Well, it's a great, I think it's amazing. Like, I never sort of think about it. Like, it's that thing of like when you, like, it's like when somebody heckles you and you come back from it.
Yeah.
Like, so people are like, how did you come up with it that quick? And I'm just like, I don't fucking know.
I have no idea. I was in the Matrix watching it all happen in slow motion. Yeah. I
genuinely just responded without any thoughts. And like, so, but the rest of the time, my brain is a little bit active and it always has been. And so I thought I'd try a bit of meditation, and it's really good. You just sit in a, you know, I do Buddhist meditation, even though I'm not a Buddhist. I just like their bells and stuff. And also, it's weird. It's really cheap. Like, if you do transcendental, which is quite, that's a trendy one that celebrities use.
Yeah.
You've got to pay, it's like, I don't know how much it is. It's like £500 a sort of 6 month membership, whatever. If you go to a Buddhist walking centre, you can have a guided meditation set, and it's just like, afterwards they just like, just make a donation. So give them a fiver and, you know, they're chuffed to bits. And it's for an hour, they'll just talk you through some nice little meditation, like, techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So now, yeah, so I use that, and I use you've heard some of my weird music.
What is it called? Theta waves, is it?
Theta waves, yeah. It's another thing, because I find, if I am, you know, if I've got some ideas and I just want to sit and look through them and think about them, again, my brain just, like, gets so easy distracted. It's much easier when I sit down with somebody to talk through ideas, because I'm concentrating on what they're saying, and then I'm telling them my thing, and we're going back and forth. So you've got some sort of direction in that conversation. But when you're sitting there trying to work on ideas yourself, your brain is just like, you know, something will just come up and be like, what are you going to have for your tea tonight? And I'm like, oh, shut up. So you end up having this argument with yourself about trying to concentrate. But I found this, it's like theta waves. It's used for meditation as well. It's music that is like, has different frequency levels of, you know, different like beats and waves and all. It sounds proper hippie stuff. But I find it really good to have in the background when writing, because it's not silence, your brain doesn't go all crazy, but it's also not music that distracts you with like, oh, this is a good song, or some words or whatever, or a song you come up you haven't heard in ages. It's just background noise.
Yeah.
I find it makes your brain totally just find that level of being able to just think about what you're thinking about without going off on different tangents. So yeah, I mean, I've recommended it to quite a few comics who struggle to sit and write on their own. To just, yeah, just whack it on. It's like, yeah, theta waves and binaural beats, guys.
Binaural beats. This is your blurb on the website, the king of binaural beats.
It's proper hippie shit, but I do recommend it for people that, you know, aren't doing anything creative when they're on their own.
Are there things you see people do on stage that annoy you?
Oh.
Like, you're very protective of comedy. You really love it.
Oh, totally.
What things get out of your nose that you see in comedy?
Crap edgy comedy. Like, just crap. You know, like... I love seeing somebody talk about something like that, like, in an interesting way. You watch someone like Steve Hughes, who will talk about, you know... He could talk about any old... you know, sort of shit, and it's funny because he's a funny man, and he can say, what I think is this is when you know somebody who's good at doing sort of, you know, political or social commentary comedy, is when they say something you disagree with,
yeah,
but you still find it funny.
Yes,
that is incredible, you know. And there's not that many people that sort of do it, but the worst is when somebody just talks, you know, just goes for the easy laugh, like on a rape joke, or I can't watch that. So it's just, I find it's really cynical, and like, the worst thing is the way that an audience reacts to it. They react to it like, oh, I can't believe he's saying that. And it's like, what you don't know is that's the easiest thing to get a laugh from.
Yeah.
Not just get a laugh, but get like a round of applause and that sort of like, yeah, because you're not just laughing at it, you're also laughing at the fact that they've said it. The reaction to it isn't an honest comedy reaction. It's got so many more different levels. So I really dislike that. I dislike fake banter.
Okay.
You know, when a compere just goes like, so you know, in front of you, you married? And they're like, yeah. And then they just tell a story about them being married.
Yeah.
But it's like, you're not comparing, man. You're just, I don't like that.
It's a good point. There's a lot of it.
There's some things that are really crap, but that I really like as well.
Go on.
One of my favourite ones is when is the emergency audience participation. This is my favourite one, and not you. You sort of, you still see the odd established comic do it, but It's great when you see like a sort of a newer act, and it sounds horrible, but you know, like if you're at like a sort of a big weekend comedy club,
sure,
and you've got like a 10 minute spot on, so there's an open spot and they're a bit nervous and they're all excited about their 10, and you see it at the Comedy Store a lot, and they go out and they're all, you know, it's not their fault. If you're doing a 10 at the Comedy Store on a Friday, Saturday night, chances are you're on with a belter of a bill.
Yeah,
like I can't remember, I was there last time, and you know, there was the open spot was on it was me, guys, and there was like Terry Alderton, flipping John Maloney.
Yeah,
I can't remember who else, but like, you know, they're proper big circuit hitters, man. Mm. Everyone's gonna smash that gig, and then you get a 10 minute spot go on, and they might be good, but they're not gonna, you know, be able to just bang it like the others. And then they do something, and it just doesn't get a laugh, and then you just get a pause, and they're like, any couples in?
Yeah.
My favourite one is that joke doesn't get anything. Who's drinking tonight?
Yeah.
Who's drinking? It's Friday night in the fucking Comedy Store. 400 people are drinking. But it's that emergency, like proper, just like, oh, where is it?
Yeah.
Like an ejector seat.
No, lovely.
Oh, I love it. That's one of my favourites. So there's things like that that I don't think are shit. I think they're really funny.
Yeah.
Especially if you sort of do them on purpose.
Yeah.
Like that's, again, it's that thing of, can be a bit in-jokey, but isn't, like, we've been doing it on this little run,
yeah,
of now and again dropping in a really sort of crappy like a line that, you know, you've heard bad comics say,
yeah,
and just doing it just for our own amusement. It's like really funny,
just to give you a chance to go on stage,
because that's what I do. I make that noise if I ever make a proper clanger on stage, rather than try and wash over it with like any I will just go, I will make a noise,
draw a big red circle around it.
I love it. It's like Benny Boot's a really good one for if he does a joke that doesn't get a laugh. He once did something, so I don't know why this was so funny, he did a joke, didn't get a laugh, and he just to himself through the mics went, oh shit, that joke was shit. And it was such an honest moment that the crowd then laughed.
Yeah.
So I think if something doesn't work, you should just address it. Don't do like, oh, that's new. Or
yeah.
Just
sure.
Say, guys, just so you are aware, I also know that was shit.
Yeah.
And they will appreciate that more.
I really thought that was good. I believed with my whole heart that that would make you laugh.
Oh, another one I hate. That deserves more.
What? Oh, God, yeah.
I will be the judge of that.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? You don't fucking make the rules.
What you mean is, last time I said that, probably better. It got more. The end.
Or last time, it deserved less.
Yeah.
That's what
I'd love to see someone use that on stage. Get a huge laugh and go, that actually deserved less.
I've done that before.
Oh, amazing.
Do you know who's really funny at this? When we first got here, we watched Stephen K. Amos do his show here.
Yeah.
And Stephen is, you know, he's one of these charismatic, he goes into the audience and all that. And he said something, somebody said something from the audience.
Yeah.
And he just responded.
Yes. And he thought he was being heckled and he slammed the guy, didn't he?
But what he said didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It was a really bad put down. But it got a massive round of applause. And after it, they stopped laughing. He went, that didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And told them, you just clapped nothing.
Yeah.
And I think I think it's really funny to do that sometimes.
I think the bit I was referring to, I thought you were going to say, was when he used that, you know, it's a well-worn thing of going, see that silence? You did that.
That was great.
I did that. And then that's a well-worn bit.
He did it for so long.
He did it for ages ago. And that. And he got another laugh. And that.
Yeah.
And he just modulated how he was saying every time, and that. That as well, and it just got laugh. Like, you must have been doing it for 2 minutes. Oh, it was hysterical.
Yeah. And it's that thing, I think sometimes these sort of, you know, some people roll out these crap old, like, where'd you learn to whisper in a helicopter?
Yeah.
Which is crap, but if you've got an audience that know their comedy, it's funny to do one for a laugh and then play around with it.
Yeah.
And sort of, yeah. But I just don't like people that just use cynical shit on stage. My biggest bugbear. Or what else do I dislike? What's that?
I was about to mind playing a guitar. I thought you'd run out. I was going,
I don't mind a good musical act. I love like.
No. I was implying that was a good
point. Oh, right. You're saying I don't love musical comedy.
No, I mean,
most of it.
Just write down 1:04, lose that.
What else? Is there anything else I would really dislike? Well, just people that are dickheads, isn't it? I mean, in like dressing rooms, people that have got really bad big egos.
Yeah,
I don't like that. We're not. you know, and again, this I tend to find it with edgy comics.
Yeah.
They tend to think they're doing something that has a lot more worth than it does.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, they'll go out and they'll reap and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, because people are lapping it up and it makes them think that they are genuinely sort of like on the wave of,
yeah,
you know, edginess. And it's like, you're not, mate, you're just a fucking idiot talking shit. You sound like me when I was 15.
That's true, man. I always think of them as people who like write slogans on their pencil case.
Yeah.
When they're 14.
It's just like, you know, it's like the whole thing, like Bill Hicks was a very good comic, but he was, and he was one of the people that I laughed, I think he's very funny despite me disagreeing with some of the stuff he says, because he wasn't a flipping prophet, you know what I mean? He wasn't, nothing he said, I never listened to Bill Hicks, and you know, well, I did when I was young, like, yeah, not when I was young, when I first got into comedy, because I didn't know anything about comedy, I was young, I remember being like, what, 19, 20, and I listened to a Bill Hicks album and I was like, oh my god, somebody's finally saying it.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But within 2 years I'd grown up a bit and I'd seen all the other comedy that I could see, and I was like, oh, actually he's just a good comic. And as I've got older and got my own opinions about everything more, the less I've really paid much attention to Bill Hicks' message, and I've just enjoyed more his jokes. You know, I'd much prefer, and this is what annoys me actually, yeah, this is it, here we go, I finally, this is what, yeah, if I talk for long enough I'll get to a good point. Which is how my Edinburgh shows normally pan out. What annoys me is that it's only comics that stress that they say they've got a message that are ever given the sort of, you know, the praise of having a message.
Yes.
Basically, if you're banging on about some edgy shit, people go like, yeah, he's talking about some stuff. Whereas I've seen people like, I've seen people like Cochran, you know, someone who on the face of it is sort of just having being a bit waffly and telling some lovely stories, but I've come away from a Cochrane show having a bigger understanding of his world view than I ever would from somebody who's just going out and just banging
shouting out the slogans.
And it really annoys me because it shouldn't be the way that people only respond to it being thrown in their faces, you know. There's some great comics like who you know, you come away sort of having a real understanding of what they're about, even though at no point have they sort of openly
and said, and this is what I'm about.
This is why I think David Cameron's a cunt. Sort of thing. You know, I'll actually get a much sort of nicer understanding of how they feel about the world, and they'll have done it in an understated way. So I don't, it annoys me that often, probably, and it might, yeah, probably in the press, they probably will, again, only sort of ever give weight to people's opinions that are shouting about it rather than actually just throwing it out there and letting other people pick it up. So that's my biggest, that's what I really don't like.
So our contemporaries or people who are on the circuit, just for 1 minute to the circuit, who do you think particularly inspires you or has influenced you over the years? Which of the people, and I guess what I'm asking for is the sort of less obvious kind of, you know what I mean? That's why I say the circuit rather than...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, like, obviously, you know, there's... Oh, yeah, Addy was probably the...
I remember us talking about him before, yeah.
He was the one... you know, he's probably the reason I did stand-up. He's the only one I remember from that night. It was the first time I saw live comedy. And I still think he's one of the most naturally gifted comics on the circuit. Well, after that, the biggest comic that I think had an effect on what I do, and he's not a circuit comic, he's dead, but... just sort of want to give him a little reference is because after I listened to Bill Hicks and all that, I remember my first couple of years I was a little bit edgy because I was just naive and young, and I remember my mate gave me a Mitch Hedberg album, first CD that he did, and after that totally changed my, not changed my style, but I was, it, that made me realise you can just be silly and get away with it if you're funny. So that changed everything, and I think then that's why I now really like people that are just silly.
Yes.
Like you know, Cochran. I remember seeing Cochran do a bloody routine about his favourite cooker hob, and I was like, that is just brilliant. Listening to a grown man just talk about how it used to be like back left. Come on, man, that is gold. But I also, there's loads of people that I sort of, you know, there's people that don't do the sort of comedy I do that I just think are just so good. Like Sean Walsh is an example of somebody who I remember, like, I couldn't believe how good he was so quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember doing a weekend at Brighton Comedia, and it was one of the first weekends I ever closed it. And Sean was, you know, he'd been around a little bit of time. He just started, you know, hitting big. Like, he started not hitting big like in fame, but he just hit that stride where he was just, you know, suddenly just booming gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember somebody dropped out who was meant to be in the middle, and Walsh, they called Walsh in.
Mm.
And I remember, like, you know, I'd only started out a couple of years before him, but he, in the middle, he was, like, almost unfollowable. He just totally smashed the shit out of it. And it's just observational stuff, but it's good observational stuff. Mm. And I can't do it. I don't see that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and
yeah.
He'll say something like, do you know when you bang your head on a bus and everyone looking? Yeah. I'll be like, fucking yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I literally have never thought of it. Yeah. Like, he's one of those people that does make me think, oh, yeah, I do think that.
Yeah.
But I never remember those things to note down.
Have you ever tried? Have you ever tried to do
proper observational?
Yeah,
I do the odd bit, like. But again, I never do one that's proper. Everything I do is always a bit like, yeah, I do. We do see that, Carl, but it's a bit weird.
Yeah,
I've got. I had one in my last. Was it last December show? About cut up fruits in supermarkets, about the fact that you can buy pre-cut fruits.
I remember that. Yeah,
and yeah. And the whole thing was that that's unacceptable because fruits they grow so that we can eat them already. Yeah. And I basically said, the only ones that should be there are melons and pineapples because they're really hard to eat on the go.
Yeah.
And then I just sort of told this, but again, I then started talking about how I turned it into talking about evolution and how evolution essentially made, you know, apples perfect, but then made pears for people that couldn't work it out. So I had to put a handle on it. So it starts as observational, but ends up just being weird and wacky.
Sure.
So I can't do that thing of just saying, do you know when you do this?
Yeah.
Bosh, and it's a proper punchline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people can just do that. And it annoys me that people sort of criticise that because it is a skill.
Yeah.
You know when people say, yeah, what McIntyre does is easy, and you're like, no, it's not.
No.
And open spots. I've seen open spots on stage slag off McIntyre.
Yeah.
That's easy. And I was like, easy. He smashes the fucking O2,
yeah.
And you're dying in the shit and bucket. whatever gig they're doing.
We've all gigged at the shit and bucket. It strikes me, I'd like to create that to be an illusion, just to keep referring to it on the phone. Do you ever play the shit and bucket? No, it had closed by the time I got it.
It's that game with Peter Kay. He's probably one of the most, you know, the comic that most gets slagged off by other comics. But, you know, if you watch his early DVDs that he's since just re-released, they are actually, he's an incredible performer.
Mm.
But he can get a laugh with a raise of his eyebrows, which is not easy. It's really hard. You've got to have something about you. So, yeah, I don't like people that just criticise that sort of stuff. And, you know, not everything has to be wacky. Sometimes it's good to just have some people that just can go out and appeal to, you know, a lot of people. I think that's good. But I think Walsh has got something that, yeah, he's got a sort of, he's like McIntyre if McIntyre was a fucking rock star. It's frightening. When you see Walsh on form, it's amazing.
What is the value of Edinburgh to you? How do you see the Edinburgh experience? How do you put those shows together? Do you write? Is it just your best stuff at the moment, or do you write to a theme? What's the Edinburgh thing to you?
I tend to sort of do each one a bit different. Like, I absolutely love Edinburgh. I don't like being away from home for a month, but I think, I never think about the finances of it, you know, so that's a big thing. Like, I just think it's a place where once a year you can go for a month and do something that you should be proud of, and people will come and see it, and you might get stuff out of it. But you'll always get something out of it. Even it depends what you, but it's what you want out of it, isn't it? Like, if you want to, by the end of it, have a quality show that then you can take to some comedy festivals and do that, and go, that's the place to be. If you want to, you know, get seen by people, is the place to be. Like, there's so many different reasons, but I think a lot of people just get put off by, well, I'm just going to waste 10 grand, aren't I? And it's like, you don't have to waste 10 grand. You can do it in free fringe. You can, you know, you could probably get a small room at, like, you know, even probably the Underbelly, some of them, you know, the Gilded Balloon, and just don't go up with one of the big promoters who's
charge you through the roof. You know, there's always ways of doing it. I just think you've got to do it for yourself. I love coming up with a new show. I don't. Sometimes I write to a theme. Sometimes I don't. I just do whatever is I'm feeling when I start writing it. And some years I start writing it early. Some years I'll write it late. Latest ever, 2011. Wrote it in June.
Nice.
Oh my god.
Yeah, June. And it was actually a good show. You know? It was a really good stand-up show.
Okay.
Like, it was proper, like...
So you just come up with a...
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Generic, or not a generic title.
Out of all my shows, this is going to be my fifth. Only number four had a title that was for the show.
Gotcha.
Like, I had the idea for the show when I came up with the title. All the other years, I do the title as vague as it can be.
Yeah.
And then I write the show afterwards.
Okay.
Because the title doesn't have to. I mean, again, I'm one of these sort of. I know it's probably total bullshit, but I don't really believe all the shit that PR people and marketers say.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's nonsense when they say, like, you need a really strong hook for your show and all that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you write a really funny show and you just start, you know, in the first week you get, you know, the people that see it really like it and they sort of spread the word, and if you do some late shows and you smash them...
Yeah,
I think you can get on a roll in Edinburgh and just do really well. I don't think you need a show called "My Mum Died and I'm Really Sad and I Want to Talk About It" and have photos of you sitting on a fucking outside a cemetery. What I mean is, you know, I'm with Avalon, who are a big agency, and you know, sometimes you see, obviously, they sometimes try and guide your Edinburgh stuff down a certain route, but if you've got to tell him, like, if you want to do your own thing, you've got to say to him, no, I'm at the end of the day, I'm paying for this.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I want it to look, this is how I want it. I don't want it marketed as some shit that it's not going to be. I want it marketed how I want it marketed. And normally, I think if you just say, look, this guy's funny, come and see it, and he's just, you know, that's the best way to do it without falling into all that nonsense. You know, we're the artistes, we're just meant to show up, be funny for an hour a day. And piss off and get drunk. I think some people just get too caught up in the business side of it. Just a purist, Stu.
Great. There we go. That's the end.
Oh, don't leave it on that, mate. That's wanky.
I'm going to leave it right there.
So that was Carl. He's just lovely, isn't he? He's great. If you've not seen Carl, you've got to track him down. This does feel weird because he's literally outside the door. I don't know if he's still listening. The Oyster Story is one of my all-time favourite bits, and he's got such a naturally daft sense of humour. He's a brilliant act. Back to the Australians over the next few weeks. Thank you to Carl. Thanks to Graham Crockford and Dan Melrose for the music. And I will speak to you very soon. Bye for now.
Yeah. Carl said something really interesting about.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.